All right, well, I'm really, really incredibly pleased to introduce our first speaker for today. Dr. Valerie Tirico is a psychologist by trade and former director of the Children's Behavior and Learning Clinic in Bellevue, Washington. Drawing on her professional training and personal experience being raised in an evangelical family, she's written prolifically on diverse issues such as psychology of religious faith, human rights, the intersection of politics and religion, and some of the shared moral virtues that appear in common with many of the world's religious doctrines. Much of her work is featured on the Huffington Post, as well as her frequently updated Waypoint blog, and additionally, she's worked to develop a popular YouTube channel exploring emotions and cognitive science related to religious faith. Her recent book, Trusting Doubt, A Former Evangelical Looks at Old Beliefs in a New Light, explores the inconsistencies within the fundamentalist Christian traditions and offers personal insight into the application of constructive curiosity to our most closely guarded beliefs. Her books and columns have received numerous accolades from non-believers and the faithful alike, celebrating both her lucid writing style, but also her endeavor to promote a healthy interfaith and intercultural dialogue on matters of religion and spirituality. So we're really glad to have her here, all the way from Washington State. So please give a warm welcome to Dr. Valerie Tirico.
I should start out by thanking Brian. Brian, I'd like to get a copy of that introduction so that now I finally know who I am and what I'm doing, and it would be really helpful to be able to share that with other people. You all actually got a sucker to get up early on Saturday morning, because when it comes to religion, I am actually a slow study. I made it all the way through high school despite an eating disorder, bulimia, that I couldn't pray away. I made it all the way through college at Wheaton College, Billy Graham's alma mater, despite a suicidal depression triggered by the fact that I couldn't pray away my eating disorder. And I made it almost all the way through graduate school before I finally gave up on my version of the evangelical Christian God. By contrast, my friend Jeff figured things out in the second grade. He was at a Catholic school, and one day the nuns actually tried to pour holy water over the head of the only black kid in the school because he was fighting all the time, which must mean that he was being, affected by Satan, and they needed to exorcise the devil. And Jeff looked at them and thought, it's not the devil. It's because everybody picks on him. Today, Jeff is a child psychologist at Seattle Children's, which is ironically the place where I lost the last shreds of my evangelical Christian beliefs. I was about 26 at the time, in the final stages of an internship for my counseling psychology degree, and one of the rotations, the one at Children's Hospital, required that we work with the families of children who are on the medical units. And the little guy who did me in, I don't remember his name, he was about 2 years old and had a spinal cord tumor that was going to leave him paraplegic, even if he survived the arduous course of treatment that was supposedly going to extend his life. And, you know, maybe it was his inability to understand why people who looked nice kept hurting him. Maybe it was his inability to figure out why he couldn't walk anymore. Maybe it was the fact that his parents were so tender and simply wanted to take their child home and love him and let him go. But something inside me broke. At that point, I had been, as I would like to say, cobbling my faith together with duct tape and baling wire. And I just realized, saying the words duct tape and baling wire, that I'm supposed to be hitting slides for you. So I'm going to accelerate past. Or not. Accelerate past the nuns. As I said, holding my faith together, evolving a more and more idiosyncratic form of faith as I struggle to kind of hang on to the rational contradictions and moral contradictions that make up evangelical fundamentalism. And I finally, I lost it, and I said to the God in my head, I am not making excuses for you anymore. And it turned out he disappeared. That was all that was left was the wire. So I went on from there and didn't really think about things much until George Bush started turning evangelicalism into public policy, and then I decided I had a thing or two I wanted to say about that. The because what the I tell these two stories to because I want to say there that the paths out of faith are as different as the paths in, and whether or not somebody needs a journey out of faith really depends on how deeply they were in, what kinds of beliefs their religion propagated, and how much of the social support system came from religious belief. If you look at a place like exchristian.net, which has been one of my favorites for years in terms of internet sites that provide support for recovering Christians, what you see on the forums is a lot of people talking about the experience of acute loneliness coming out of faith. A Christian can basically go anywhere in the world and find a ready-made community simply by walking through the door of a church. But a former believer or somebody who's in doubt can find themselves feeling deeply alone, even at the dinner table surrounded by people they love, but thinking, if only they knew what I really believe. Because religion can get in so deeply, you know, some of the people who end up feeling the most lonely are people who have been in some form of ministry, and evangelicalism tries to make, missionaries out of everybody, but ministers in particular end up feeling completely isolated during the journey out when they first start having questions, because so much depends on it. My friend Rich Lyons, who lives in Seattle, was an apostolic minister in Texas, and when he started having doubts about even peripheral aspects of his faith, like does God really need for women to wear dresses, he ended up losing not only his livelihood and his congregation, but ultimately his wife, his home, access to his daughter. And he arrived in Seattle with the contents of his car and job skills that were 15 years out of date. Fortunately, he got a job by resuscitating some old radio skills that he had, and he now works at a radio station in Seattle and produces a podcast called Living After Faith, which is his way of kind of giving back to people who are on a similar journey to his. And then Richard Dawkins, as many of you know, and others helped recently kicked off something called the Clergy Project, to help people on that journey so that they had a form of community, because the experience of loneliness and not lacking community is one of the things that has been one of the great barriers to people being able to leave faith. In fact, Marlene Winnell tells a story of the few patients that she's lost who went back into fundamentalism. It was simply because they couldn't bear feeling so isolated by religions that shunned them when they started asking questions. When I talk about things getting in deeply, one of the constructs in psychology that's helpful in terms of thinking about that is a term called introjects. And what happens when we're young, a toddler would play in traffic without even being told to, and so they need constant supervision. But what happens is we create essentially a virtual copy of our parents in our own heads. And then once you've got the copy of your mom in your head saying, don't go out into the street after that ball, then you can be actually left alone in the front yard. The problem is that at some point, having your mom there in your head, or having your preacher there in your head, like say, for example, when somebody really hot has just unbuttoned the top button of your shirt, is not so great anymore. It doesn't contribute to independence. It actually gets in the way. And so people have to do a lot of work excavating the messages that were laid down early in life, things that you kind of don't even realize often are still there. But if you start paying attention, you find out that you're reacting to life or making decisions based on things that were instilled in you before you were even old enough to have the cognitive capacity for questioning. One of those things is this concept of original sin, and I was giving a talk for a group of Hindus who wanted to understand evangelical fundamentalism better because of the rampant proselytizing that was dividing their home villages in India and splitting families down the middle. And afterwards, a woman came up to me and said, is what you said really true, that Christians think babies are born evil? I tried to, again, to kind of explain to her this doctrine of original sin, and she said to me, when Hindu babies are born, we whisper in their ears, you are perfect, you are a spark of the divine. That sense in Christianity that we are so defective, that God can't stand us, is something that people struggle often for years or even decades to eradicate. I was working last week next to my friend Alex, who's a carpenter and who used to be a part of a Christian cult, and I asked him, if you were doing a talk on recovery from religion, what would you want to say to people? And he said, tell them they are okay just the way they are. But Alex is two decades out, I should say, and he still struggles with that. And when I mentioned his comment to other people, they had the same reaction. So because it gets in so deep, and recovery from religion often requires some kind of a trigger or triggering situation for people to finally kind of get out the door. Sometimes it's rejection or hypocrisy that they see in the church. Sometimes it's a life crisis like a divorce or the death of a loved one. Sometimes people just get a little too personal in their experience of the ugliness in the world. Sometimes the contradictions, the moral and rational contradictions, add up and hit a tipping point. And Christians would be shocked if they knew how often people end up leaving because a devoted Christian picked up the Bible and actually started reading it and got a glimpse of all of the atrocities there. But Christianity has an immune system, or at least that's how I describe it. It's got a built-in set of beliefs and behaviors and things like that that basically inoculate people against information from the outside. When you talk to somebody who is a determined believer, it can feel like you're talking to a wall. I sometimes imagine members of my own family as people who are surrounded by these stainless steel walls with no foothold or handhold, and there's simply no path in. And when I find myself thinking that, I sometimes have not such kind thoughts in response. But the reality is that life does bring along these crisis points that allow people a window of opportunity. And when that happens, it's really important for those of us who are on the outside for them to already have some sense that we are available and some sense that there is conversation out there, some sense that there is evidence out there, some sense that there are arguments out there, some sense that there is social support out there. And that is why, for example, Dr. Daryl Ray, who was here yesterday, has started recoveryfromreligion.org and has launched a therapist referral project. He's created a network of social support groups that are kind of self-help or mutual support, as well as kind of other kinds of resources. Marlene Winnell, who is a psychologist in the Bay Area, does a lot of writing on this topic and also has provided both online conversations, long-distance phone conversations, and actual opportunities for people to meet each other in the process. And when I talk about the process, I think there are several stages. In the first stage, people start having doubts, and they've been taught that doubt is from the devil, literally. It's a sign of weak faith. And during the first phase, very often people really ramp up their energy simply to fend off doubt. So they spend more time in church. They may engage in missionary work. They may actually, start working on actually convincing other people that Christianity is true, because if they can convince other people, or whatever religion it is, I assume I know Christianity, and that's why I speak about Christianity. But the idea is then if you can convince someone else, it must be true. During the second phase, then, people become more ambivalent. They start feeling like they know that what they believe is not true. They may then ramp up reading materials that are confirmatory of their exodus from Christianity, of skepticism, or whatever their journey may be. My friend Garrett Abney, who was the head of the Secular Student Alliance at the University of Washington, said that his parents, when he was in this phase, told him that that materials that contradicted their religion were spiritual pornography, is what they called it. And because he was reading pornography, they wouldn't allow him around his younger siblings unsupervised. Now, I have to say, I'm kind of proud, actually, to think of myself as a pornographer of this sort. The only The only problem I have with it is that I actually thought that if I wrote pornography, I could make money at it. But the bottom line here is that at this point in the game, people really need information. And information is important not just for making the transition, but there's a whole lot of residual bullshit that stays in your mind once you've become convinced that faith isn't real. And doubts, I have a friend who's 85. He converted out of Christianity, probably 40 years ago. And he's an attorney. He's a very smart man. But as he has now entered a kind of protracted dying process in which he's slowly losing the battle against prostate cancer, he finds those old images of hell coming back up. And he says, I know intellectually it's not true, but what you know is that in your gut doesn't always kind of respond to what your head is telling you. And those messages were in so early and so deep that he's still continuing to struggle with it. When people finally come to terms with their loss of faith, it's not unusual to need to go through a grieving process. Even if Jesus isn't real, or even if kind of whatever you might have believed isn't real, the loss is. Religion provides a host of benefits for people who subscribe. It provides a sense of community, a sense of meaning and purpose, a channel for wonder and joy. And all of that is, those are basic human needs that then have to be replaced. So it's normal for people to need to go through a grieving process regardless of whether what they believed before is true. And again, I want to say, not everyone needs to go through that, but some people do, and it depends on what their experience of religion was. It depends on who they are as a person. Sometimes in that process, people actually do hit a point that they're just stuck. They're stuck in grief. The grief is turning into depression. They're stuck in anger. A lot of Christians are told that anger is a negative, a bad emotion, and so people tend to suppress it. The reality is that anger is an activating emotion. It gives us the energy often to do what we need to do when we wouldn't be able to get over the barriers otherwise. But people coming out of religion often feel like anger is taboo, and if they let it out, it's going to be destructive, it's going to be too big, it's going to be out of control. And unfortunately, learning to express anger in non-destructive ways actually is a process. And so if you don't have any practice, the first few times you do it, it may feel out of control and ugly and destructive. And yet, that can be the only way to learn how to do anger, how to leverage anger in ways that are actually adaptive, is to begin taking a chance on that process. When people get stuck in anger or depression or grief, whatever it might be, those are the times that they really need something beyond self-help and mutual support that is available in the secular community. And that's why this project that is about a matchmaking service for people coming out of religion and people who are therapist trained professionals is so important. One of the first places that I encountered when I began exploring, engaging on this topic, was a website that's now an archive called losingmyreligion.com. And on the front page of losingmyreligion.com was a poem that I want to read to you because I continue to find it particularly powerful. It's called Awake. I woke up to an empty room. No more angels watching over me. No more demons to be held at bay by the invocation of an anglicized version of a Hellenized version of a Hebrew name. I woke up to an empty room, just a room, four walls, ceiling, floor, just a room, nothing more. I woke up to an empty room and embraced the solid air. I woke up to an empty room and knew myself awake. So in those moments of being awake, of being lucid, during the journey out of religion, that's the time that you get to actually, dominant emotions shift from focusing on who you were and what you've lost to being able to focus on the excitement of being out of the box, of thinking about what you want to become. And people deal with that opportunity in all kinds of ways, starting to say, what is enough for me? Tolerating living with unanswered questions. One person wrote, and I've quoted them repeatedly, I'd rather live with unanswered questions than unquestioned answers. The people start figuring out what they want to do in the coming out process. What does it mean to say to other people, I no longer am a religious believer, especially in places where it seems like the whole community is. What do we want to call ourselves? Because there's lots of labels available, and different labels fit for different people. Which values and habits from your religion do you want to retain? And I have to say that I kind of think that there is now, the secular community itself has matured to the point, the movement, that we are beginning to ask some of these same questions of ourselves as a broader community, not just as individuals. So really basic questions like, what's the foundation of our moral structure? Are there moral absolutes? What does it mean to reclaim or to claim for ourselves outside the context of supernaturalism and superstition and woo? What does it mean to reclaim some of the things that are really central to the experience, the deep experience of being human and being a part of the universe made conscious? And then lastly, how do we want to engage in the community around us? How do we create structures that allow us to begin doing some of the really pro-social things that religion has done, like providing paths for philanthropy and engagement in making the world a better place? And, you know, I think of Julia Sweeney's comment on letting go of God. If any of you haven't heard it, it's a total must. But one of the things she said is when she realized that there wasn't any God out there, she's like, oh my God, we have to take care of each other. And so thinking about what it means for us to do that, not just as individuals, because we tend to be a bunch of wild cats, but also thinking about what it means to do that as a community. And so I want to stop there and open up for questions. But, you know, one of the things I want to just say to you is, regardless of where you are on this journey, you need to give yourself space for it to be a journey, for it to be a process. And the same thing with people around you. And don't assume that because they aren't accepting what you have to say right now, that they're not taking in any of it, that there's not some subterranean change going on. Thanks.
We've got time for a few questions if you want to come right down this aisle here. Or I can come to you. Any questions?
My question goes to the political aspect of this. I know there's a lot of people fighting Bushism out there, the radical right that use guns, God, and gay for voting. And I'm involved with groups that have symposiums and come together to fight back against this. And there are a lot of groups, I mean, whenever these come together, there are faith-based symposium in there. They'll talk about it. Never secular. And I'm wondering what we can do about that and how you see this and morality relating to the political sphere.
Well, I think we have a powerful story to tell. And in fact, the reason I actually got involved in writing about the theological and psychological aspects of Christian fundamentalism was because what was going on politically. I mean, it's incredibly destructive, the harm being done not only to people as individuals, but also to our whole society. I mean, it's not just the kind of the core tenets that they are propagating, but the whole notion that our political system should be faith-based rather than based on evidence, the best evidence available, and pragmatism, a sense of what works. So thank you for that. You got me just in time, because if nobody had come up for questions, I was going to start ranting about contraception and reproductive rights. And the one thing I would say about that actually is, I mean, it's a case in point. We have new reproductive, long-acting, reversible contraceptive technologies that could make teen pregnancy a thing of the past, essentially, and that would mean that the rate of abortions would drop to a percentage point of what it is now. But the barricade is religious fundamentalism.
In the lead-in to your talk, you talked about how you had been a bulimic and how the church had been, at least in part, responsible for a downturn in your psychological condition.
What can the atheist and skeptic community do for people with mental illness to maybe take up where they failed? What can we fix?
Well, the challenge of the religious community, you know, when I was a teenager with bulimia, I went to my pastors. Who do you go to, right? And they prayed with me, and then I went home thinking, great, it's over. And of course it wasn't over. So I think that part of what we can do as a secular community is to begin making clear to people that there are resources out there, that there are people available who can talk about mental illness, who can talk about the struggles we all face as, you know, from another lens, from another perspective. And that's core. That's key.
For about 2 years, I've been engaged in an email debate with an evangelical person. And I've tried to point out all kinds of contradictions that in faith and all the kind of rational arguments that I can think of. And I'm wondering if just by my maybe not very convincing argumentation that I'm only helping to build up his resistance, if
yes.
You know what I mean. And I'm wondering if there's some kind of different approach that I could take via email.
I don't spend a lot of time arguing because I think that's exactly what it does. Unfortunately, I think that what you want is to make resources available and out there. There may be people who have had better experiences with debate than I have, and I think that's coming up next. but the reality is that a lot of times it's your presence. Think about the gay rights movement. I think there's a lot of analogies to be drawn. That you know, part of it is people being out and being human, figuring out, you know, what I said to my gay brother when he first came out is like, you are messing with people's categories because you don't fit their stereotypes. All you need to do is be you. He happens to be like the most decent person in my family, and even Christians would admit that, and so that I think is as powerful as any argumentation.
I'm not quite sure how to turn this Jeopardy. I don't know how to turn this into a question, but we spoke earlier about the problem of addictions and how there's a hegemony of faith-based treatment. Everybody's told to go to the 12-step, which is a spiritual fellowship, and rarely is it mentioned that there are science-based and secular approaches, starting with the secular organization for sobriety, but also LifeRing, Smart Recovery, Self-Management, Recovery Training, Moderation Management, all have the scientific basis and all are secular. And
thank you.
How do
thank
we get
you.
Those out to the public? So how did I turn that into a question?
Well, you just got it out to the public, so thank you very much.
Thank you.
One of the things that frustrates me most with religion is childhood indoctrination. And I'm wondering what we can do without being too intrusive, without getting too involved in how people parent to help prevent that.
The expert I would recommend on that is Janet Heimlich and her new book, Breaking Their Will. She's created a book, a website also called Child Friendly Faith. There are people in there who are non-believers. And we're out of time. So feel free to catch me during a break if there's anybody with more questions. I'm going to be around at lunchtime, and I'm going to be around all day tomorrow.